Ms. Hamill, Ms. McRae, I'd like to thank you both for your interest in the inquiry and for your appearance at today's hearing. The purpose of this hearing is to assist me in gathering evidence for the Climate Health WA inquiry into the impacts of climate change on health in Western Australia. My name is Taran Weeramantri, and I've been appointed by the Chief Health Officer to undertake the inquiry. Beside me is Dr. Sarah Joyce, the inquiry's project director. If you could please be aware that the use of mobile phones and other recording devices is not permitted in this room, so please make sure that your phone is on silent or switched off. This hearing is a formal procedure convened under Section 231 of the Public Health Act 2016. While you are not being asked to give your evidence under oath or affirmation, it is important you understand that there are penalties under the Act for knowingly providing a response or information that is false or misleading. This is a public hearing and a transcript of your evidence will be made for the public record. If you wish to make a confidential statement during today's proceedings, you should request that that part of your evidence be taken in private. You've previously been provided with the inquiry's terms of reference and information on giving evidence to the inquiry. Before we begin, do you have any questions about today's hearing?
No, thank you.
For the transcript, could I ask each of you to state your name and the capacity in which you are here today? And if you would also please just briefly state your name prior to speaking through the hearing.
Cheryl Hemmel, I'm the President of Health Services Union of WA.
Naomi McRae, the Secretary of the Health Services Union of WA.
Thank you. Ms. Hemmel, would you like to make a brief opening statement?
Yes, we're going to switch between the two of us in terms of answering the questions. I'll make the opening statement. The Health Services Union of Western Australia is a state union, but it's also a branch of our federal health services union. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to appear as witnesses for the inquiry. We support the state government holding this inquiry into climate health. Australian unions accept the science of climate change, so we haven't made any, we're not going to be making any contribution on that side because we take that as read. As a leading health union that covers the broadest range of health workers, we urge action to both mitigate and adapt to climate change because the impacts on health and the provision of health services will be significant. We consider that government and WA Health has a strong responsibility to do more to reduce emissions and pollution, particularly waste in hospitals in metro and regional areas, to prepare for the impacts of climate change on health and the provision of healthcare, factoring in the already significant existing stresses to maintain services. This is for a range of reasons, including a growing metropolitan population, an ageing population, rundown infrastructure, government models of care and funding, and the enormous geographic coverage. We recognise that engaging health workers in the mitigation and adaptation steps required will be crucial to success. We urge partnering with unions to ensure systemic change, and we recommend investing in research, technology and training to the workforce to better plan and prepare.
Thank you. And thank you for your time today. As you know, and for the record, we have received written submissions and are hearing in person from all designated health service providers in Western Australia. So could you first outline the history of your union, your mission and values, and the range of health sector occupations you represent? And if you could just clarify whether your union membership crosses over into other sectors such as aged care, disability services, etc.
Yes, so Naomi speaking. The HSUWA was established initially as the Hospital Salaried Officers Association in 1955 in WA. Today the HSUWA, as it's known, covers a broad range of workers in public and private hospitals and health services, pathology, radiology, aged care, disability services, community pharmacy and dental practices. In general terms, the HSUWA covers the health professional, administrative, managerial, clerical, general, technical and supervisory jobs in those sectors. So, for example, our members would include ward clerks, therapy assistants, medical scientists and pharmacists. The HSUWA became a branch of the Federal Health Services Union in 1994. Nationally, the HSU is made up of 7 branches and a national office covering well over 100,000 members across health, aged care, disability care and ambulance. The purpose of the HSU WA is to protect and further the interests of members. Like all unions, our purpose is not only industrial, but extends to safety, training, equal opportunity, and more broadly, working to improve the lives of members and their families. Some further history, in 2015, the National Council of the HSU voted to join the Climate and Health Alliance. The HSU WA is an affiliate of the peak union body in Western Australia, Unions WA, and the National HSU is an affiliate of the peak union body, the ACTU. And we've got some more to talk about on those affiliate bodies and their policies towards the end.
So it's very interesting, just that range of professions that you represent. And, when we think about health services, the kind of automatic focus goes on to doctors, nurses, and maybe allied health professionals. And we're hearing from the Chief Nursing Midwifery Officer next week and also the Chief Health Professions Officer. And so we'll get their perspective as well on that range of other professions. Be interested in your views about whether those other professions have been adequately picked up in this discussion as yet, whether we've kind of tapped into their particular expertise and concerns, or whether that's a job that's still to be done. We hear a lot about waste and things that can be improved in terms of energy efficiency, et cetera, in hospitals. But most of that discussion is fairly generic, covering the hospital. Mm. But there seems to be other viewpoints that might not yet be represented. Is that fair?
Well, I think it is fair in the sense that you also mentioned, interesting, whether we cover aged care and disability care, because when you're talking not hospitals, you're talking community and outreach facilities. So not only in the provision of community health care, but aged care and disability care, there's a whole range of people in different professional, they could be allied health, but there's also obviously carers that are going to people's homes or working in hubs or decentralised environments, essentially, to provide healthcare. So whether you've covered the field there, I'm not sure, but we cover a large part of the field,
So we are trying to gather stories about how climate change is impacting people living in this state, including, of course, staff of health services, who are a fair proportion of the population. And have you got any stories or examples of particular issues that may impact on any specific occupational groups, particularly in what I'm calling allied health, but it's really everything else, all those other professional groups that you represent, or is that something we need to look at down the track?
I'm going to answer this question. We do have some. We've got some very valuable contributions from some of our allied health members that were collected by the staff of the union that I can relay. I'll go on with what we've got prepared. We consider the evidence clear that more extreme weather events, temperature, air pollution, etc., infectious diseases, will mean more people get sick and those already unwell will get sicker. So what we're saying here is some comments from members to demonstrate the broad range of impacts that are already being experienced. So this was from a senior Aboriginal mental health worker in the Pilbara. The team is having to conduct their outreach work to communities much earlier in the day. During periods of extreme heat, they are unable to visit communities in places such as the Western Desert. The team is, however, very experienced and very conscious of looking after their own health by keeping up their hydration and not travelling during the heat of day. She doesn't know how new people would cope in this environment. And she has concerns about the impacts of climate change, particularly on renal patients in extreme heat, because the requirement to keep hydrated may negatively impact their diabetes. Another from a medical scientist in Derby. As the temperature continues to rise and there's no rain, the rate of crime in Derby has increased. This is not just caused by the temperature rise, but also due to increased alcohol and drug usage. The former could at least be linked to the heat. The workload has therefore increased. He says he's spending more on air conditioning, but the rate at which they are reimbursed hasn't been reviewed since 1968. The cost of groceries is increasing, but the quality is decreasing. fuel prices are also higher. They find it difficult to retain staff due to the difficult living and working conditions. He has stayed, but his family lives in Perth because they can't cope with the lifestyle. Another from a psychologist in child and adolescent mental health in Midland, who highlights some issues with facilities. For CAM staff, child and adolescent mental health, the issues would mainly occur in the summer months. Most CAM's clinic buildings are rented, and with the heat, there are often frequent issues with air conditioning, with systems failing or having a variable effect. For instance, if you reduce the temperature for some rooms, other rooms are too cold. If you turn it up, then some other rooms are too hot. Most staff just get on with the work and put up with it, but it does lead to frustration and irritability and probably negatively affects work output. The other issue is that the rented clinics are usually cheap to rent, not designed with environmental sustainability in mind, so our air conditioning systems go all the time, and obviously this is expensive and not helpful for environmental sustainability. At PCH, the Perth Children's Hospital, I assume environmental sustainability is built into the building design as much as possible, but with CAMS and CDC clinics, Child Development Centre clinics, the idea is just to rent something cheap, but of course it isn't cheaper. Rents always go up and so do power costs, and this approach can't be environmentally friendly in the long term. It also has an effect on their children's activities and their mental health. For patients and families, one issue I can think of is the summer heat, perhaps impacting on the lifestyles of children in our local catchment. Most families are challenged financially and live in smaller homes with tiny yards with limited areas to play and exercise. Many of the children referred to our clinic spend their away from school time indoors on social media or gaming. This, of course, has been shown by recent research in Europe to negatively affect mood. It must also add to obesity issues and self-esteem difficulties. And, of course, these little crowded houses, homes, have air conditioning systems going full-time. I guess I'm generalising a bit, but the above scenario is certainly a very common situation for children living in the sprawling new urban developments in the Swan catchment zone. And another from a podiatrist, more people in the metro area. More people have problems with their feet in hot weather, especially heat waves. For example, diabetics have increasing problems with ulceration on their feet. Diabetics who need to wear enclosed, well-fitting footwear will choose to try and cool down and then end up with ulceration. People are less motivated to follow the discipline of managing their illness in heat, even when it causes other problems. Generally, as our bodies heat up, there's an increased blood supply to the skin, and this causes fluid to move out of our vessels and into the surrounding tissue. The foot and the ankle are the lowest point in the body, so the fluid builds up and swells, causing problems and immobility, especially if people are overweight. So there's a few takeaways we've taken from this for our union. Workplace planning and health will need to consider where and how services are offered, and what incentives there will be for people to work in difficult or inhospitable environments. The ability to attract and retain staff in areas most affected by rising temperatures in WA is something that is already an issue and being managed by staff. There are also barriers to the provision of services that are based on workers going to individual homes, community care, but particularly in aged and disability care. As these workers are expected to go from home to home, they need to travel, usually by car, and they need a safe and controlled environment when they get to the client's home. They will be impacted by conditions as much as their clients. These workers are usually working alone against the clock. They may increasingly be dealing with people who are housebound. Excursions will be less likely and people are more likely to be indoors for extended periods. The community and home care system that has been designed depends on a workforce that is resourced and available to deliver it.
I'm struck with a lot of material there, and thank you for taking the time to gather those stories from your members. Just a couple of points. One is you've emphasised that it's also the impact on community and outreach workers that we need to look at, and that even issues of transport in hot conditions might become a serious issue, particularly, you know, the further north we go in the state, for example. And secondly, that whole notion that it's not just the person working in small rural communities, but it's also their family living in those communities who this might affect, and the ability then to attract and retain staff, particularly if there's, you know, parents with young children or something like that, you know, that might be a significant issue for the workforce. Is that correct?
Mm. Yes, definitely. Mm.
Thank you. Mm. We go on to something that's kind of quite specific, which is worker health and safety, which, you know, you're the experts on. It's the number one priority for almost all union and employer groups. I'll just ask, does the sector need to better understand and respond to hazard exposure in the workplace associated with extreme weather and the changing climate more broadly? And I'm thinking there, even if you think of something like heat, that it's not just heat waves, but it's the increased number of hot days, which might fall under a threshold of heat waves, but still in its aggregate leads to a different kind of problem for worker health and safety.
Yes, so we think that there is an unmet training need, but there's also a lot of work to do to better understand and respond to hazard exposure. So we obviously think that heat and the effect of dehydration have both physical and mental effects on the workers as well as their clients or patients. So there's a real safety issue around our workers in delivering, as you've just mentioned again, community care. There's also the isolation of that kind of work, which is actually quite important. And there's the physical demands of some of that work, particularly for allied health professionals such as physiotherapists. So there can be a higher turnover as well, which comes with the additional challenges. So I guess we're saying there's flow-on effects. And if the work is poorly paid, the problems are exacerbated. So we think training is essential in alerting the workforce to what may reasonably be expected of them and what to do should conditions be considered unsafe or unreasonably arduous. We think training alone won't be enough, that equipment, technology, planning and other measures of ensuring safety need to be considered depending on the work. And we think that it'll be at every level, so from the cert to a TAFE all the way through to experienced people as they retrain, they'll have to be factored in. I was also going to mention, it's a bit more general, but we did do a snap survey of members in relation to thinking about climate change and health, and I thought it might be worth mentioning that when we asked should the health sector lobby government to take action on climate change as a health issue, the response was 91% said yes, we should. I guess this goes to mitigation. And another key question was should WA Health increase the renewable energy used by hospitals and health services and reduce their waste, and that was 100% said yes. Do you think that climate change will impact on how you provide healthcare, and that was 67% said yes. So I think we're saying there's a growing and quite urgently growing awareness.
And that awareness has come through the public forums we've held across the state. And, you know, the health sector has many enthusiastic and passionate staff who have attended those forums and also given us their submissions in various ways. And they are committed to environmental sustainability and want to see change. And I suppose to close the gap between what they do at home and what they're seeing at work. How can the health system harness that enthusiasm? And what role can the Health Services Union or WA play in ensuring the health workers help co-design the change process?
Cheryl again on this one. A health system's climate response needs to maintain and improve health workforce involvement. The HSUWA is keen to encourage and support this engagement and advocates for the leadership across health to adopt meaningful climate change strategies. It needs to be a standing item on forums such as the Joint Consultative Committee meetings that are being established at the moment, where health workers can identify areas where the health service can do better with climate change remediation and propose practical local solutions. The ideas and innovation of workers need to be supported and will be an important part of the solution. While there needs to be big picture thinking and leadership, action on the ground has to be encouraged, no matter how small a step may be. This is a bit of historical detail, but staff at Royal Perth Hospital for many years led a grassroots approach to change through a group they called HEAT, appropriately, the Hospital Environmental Awareness Team. They sought to influence and improve recycling within the hospital. The group has lapsed, but it does indicate that there is interest and willingness from the workforce to play a part in solutions. We suggest something like an annual award for the HSP, the health service provider environmental group that's developed the best project. That might be one option that could be looked at, but more are needed. There should be incentives in the system and a sharing of knowledge through clear pathways. For example, if a worker thinks of better processes or systems to reduce waste, improve environmental safety, reduce unnecessary patient travel, test or procedure, etc., it's part of the solution if those ideas can be contributed, taken up and shared between HSPs. Such efforts need to be championed at the executive and board level. The government and the department and the director general should hold health service providers and private contractors against health to stated objectives to reduce and adapt to climate changes that include workforce participation, as well as clear targets and required actions with consequences for non-compliance. The government and the director general have the powers and the mechanisms to ensure this happens. The overall responsibility should sit with the system manager, but it must require action at HSP and delivery level. It's a question of will and leadership, and of course more needs to be done in those other areas outside of HSPs, as in disability and aged care. Whatever measures are chosen need to be tracked over time for the workforce to see that participation in mitigation has effect. We need to be able to track our progress and be encouraged by it. For example, how much waste has been reduced, how much support has been put into teleconferencing to avoid the need to travel for meetings, how genuine are claims that the workforce has access to flexible work, e.g. working from home to avoid travel for staff seeking to reduce commutes or to avoid exposure to pollution, etc. Cultural change and incentives are needed to keep this work front of mind. In the absence of a crisis, actions required to maintain focus on the issues of mitigation and adaptation over a long time span.
That's very kind of comprehensive. You've gone to a number of kind of recommendations there about the system and what it looks like. Not sure what the question is, but you did talk about the enormous geographic coverage. And we tend to kind of take that for granted on the one hand in Western Australia, but also perhaps kind of not think through that enough, you know, in terms of, you know, we're such an enormous state. We're the second largest subnational jurisdiction in the world, I think, after Siberia or something. You probably have a good sense of that as a union representing people right across the state. Could you reflect on that a little bit in terms of what that means for this challenge? Because, you know,
I think the challenges are different in, you know, built-up metropolitan areas to the challenges that they would face in those rural areas. I think we have more options often in the metropolitan area to make big changes that make differences, and I think it would be a little bit more... a lot more challenging in some of the rural and remote areas. But on the other hand, they're the ones that are picking up the teleconferencing, that telehealth and all that sort of stuff. So I think some of those communities are actually already benefiting from some of those sorts of initiatives, which aren't done necessarily for climate reasons, but obviously have a climate saving in terms of not flying patients back and forth all the time. So I think our members have embraced that sort of working model. And is that the sort of thing you were thinking of? Yeah. Mm.
And that's becoming a bit of a theme for us, is that it kind of doesn't matter if you're aiming for environmental savings or whether you're doing something else, such as choosing wisely, or and you're getting environmental savings or telehealth.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
It doesn't matter what you start off, as long as the effect is the...
Yes, absolutely. Right. It's very integrated, and that is, a lot of issues are integrated, aren't they? You know, you can't look at anything in isolation. Mm.
Okay, thank you. The Health Services Union of WA provides a range of member benefits, including insurance, legal assistance and the like. Are you aware of any discussion or impact of climate change on risk calculations, premiums, superannuation choices and the like? And is this an issue that has been discussed at your board or committee of management level?
Naomi, the union offers journey cover and professional indemnity insurance to financial members. Premiums are renewed annually and generally increase year to year. The Committee of Management has not yet considered the extent to which these products and their costs might be impacted by climate risk, but we think they will be impacted. One of the reasons we have professional indemnity insurance is because the registration of our allied health professionals requires insurance. So to actually practice, you need insurance. So the provision of insurance as a cost to the individual worker is actually extremely important, and it does tie in with what our comment on the gradual but systemic transfer of cost and risk from employers to employees to the independent contractor, where all those risks are taken on board by the, essentially a sole trader. So this means the cost of insuring against risk, as the cost of insuring against risk increases, the costs are going to be increasingly borne by workers unless we work out alternative models. Unions are increasingly active in engaging this casual workforce to improve their rights at work and to break through the fiction that this disenfranchised workforce has no rights to the benefits accessed by others in permanent secure positions. So we also do provide industrial advice and assistance, obviously, to our members. External legal assistance is sought for industrial disputes, some more formal disputes. At this stage, climate change risks have not been factored into the provision of these services. However, while it's hard to predict, we think that they will need to be as the work of our members changes because of the impacts of climate change as well as other changes, and it will affect their own health and as well as their capacity to provide health care services. For example, there may be the ability to work from home. I think Cheryl's just mentioned this, that the option for flexible working arrangements is something that we know will likely be part of the solution, but we'll probably need to push industrially for that to actually be better accepted and promoted by employers than it currently is.
Would you like to comment about the umbrella organisations at a state and national level? I think you said earlier that you had some more to say about Unions WA and the ACTU.
I think that comes in to question 7. We've got a bit of stuff prepared there.
Yeah. So we, as we've said, we've heard from all the health service providers. We've heard from their chairs or deputy chairs and the chief executives. And everyone's saying, and also in their written submissions, that they're doing what they can and they'd like to do more. They need support. And, you know, how can we use this inquiry to generate more support so that we can get there in terms of a sector? What's your understanding of the current level of waste in a hospital? Because there's been some articles in the hospital sector, there have been some articles that have come out in the last few months just talking about, you know, quite surprising levels of waste when you look at it in such a big sector, and that there's quite a lot of potential to reduce that. And, you know, exemplar hospitals such as Princess Alexandra Hospital in Queensland have been mentioned, but there's now increasing numbers of hospitals in WA which are doing things. Have your staff given you feedback about their general perception of what the current situation is, noting that we want to do better going forward?
We haven't really been asked. We didn't ask that in our SNAP survey, I don't think, although I think some people did mention it in their responses about the level of waste, but we didn't systematically ask about that. But I think there has been a lot of media, and we're certainly, I noticed that East Metro has joined the Greening Hospitals, forgot the exact name of the program, which I think is encouraging. Although they've only got 2 priorities I think they're pursuing to begin with, which didn't seem to actually cover waste at this point, but I don't think we've systematically surveyed them, but I'm sure it's no different here to all of the other terrible stories we've heard from everywhere else about the amount of waste that gets generated out of a hospital.
I think there's a lot of general comment that people aren't comfortable with the waste that they see in their day-to-day work. I the fact that the HSPs do not have specific targets that they are required to meet set by government to reduce their contributions to emissions and waste, I think would be a massive incentive for them to take action.
I guess the other thing I'd say about that is that in order to even know whether you're making inroads in it, we do need a bit of definition around, you know, waste you can't avoid having, and what's the scope of what should be regarded as that type of waste, and where should we be going? And that needs to be a shared learning across all facilities, really. But you can't even know whether you're making progress if you don't know where you're starting from. So I think at some point there's going to have to be some sort of definitional stuff defined about, okay, we really shouldn't be generating this much out of theatres or out of cardiac cath labs or out of wherever. And then you can see how much progress you're making over time. And I think that when people see progress against reductions in that sort of stuff, I think it keeps them heartened and engaged with the process.
So your point about reporting is important, and currently we don't have baseline either emissions data or waste data. Mm. And you're quite right again about there's quite some difficult definitional issues around waste in particular. We did previously, you know, a decade or so ago, have baseline emissions reporting. I think it's possibly technically easier to come up with some understood metrics around that. Have you got any experience with waste data or emissions data? Question that. Haven't been discussed much for some time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm interested in also the employer perspective in this, and we have got submissions from, you know, employers, health service providers, but also some other employer groups. And there's a range of opinions about whether this should be kind of a bottom-up approach or whether it needs to be a top-down approach where everything's kind of aligned to state, national and international targets. Do you have any comments about that?
Is this relating to question six particularly?
Not particularly. So it's really about the whole notion of whether we kind of get on as a sector and commit to doing things in this space and what the drivers for that would be versus waiting for, if you like, top-down guidance to do something.
Oh, Naomi, our view would be that there needs to be clear leadership and action taken in relation to what the expectations are set by government, that the HSPs should have in their agreements, their service agreements, clear and measurable targets. There should be consistency and shared knowledge and maybe the establishment of some particular units that literally look at best practices and share the knowledge. So why we would say absolutely has to come top down and there's no need to actually wait, this is a state government, this is health. The encouragement and participation of workers in the process, it won't work without that. The union should be and would advocate for as much consultation engagement with workers as possible. We'd like to use every avenue possible with our within our industrial scope to ensure that there is movement. And when I say that, I mean in relation to mitigation and waste adaptation, because this actually just going through this process with the inquiry has really elevated, I think, the concerns that are simmering around and that the action, there's a lot of scope for action to actually start now that's a far greater speed using the initiatives that people have got that in the past. I think the HEAT example is a great one where there has been grassroots and attempts, but there hasn't been across the board support and so they've fizzled out. And I think everyone's realised that actually those times we now have to actually act far more collaboratively and urgently together.
And so that point you made about how we sustain attention on this issue as opposed to that episodic attention is something we're giving thought to.
Yeah.
So keeping with that theme, do you see a role of for Health Services Union of WA and other key health unions in partnering with the health department health services and government following completion of this inquiry and consideration of its recommendations?
Cheryl, for this one, doing tag team. Yes, the union must be part of the solution on behalf of our members. Our members are essential to the process being successful. We would like to see strong partnerships developed so that workers' experiences and voices are part of the solution and that they are actively consulted as the entities work through measures to address climate change. We think the inquiry should charge the government as the primary provider and funder of healthcare to ensure mitigation strategies are urgently adapted to reduce waste and emissions across health. They should also ensure the ongoing planning for adaptation is done on the basis of evidence and research that is well-resourced and pragmatic. This should be framed as a health and economic issue. We don't want people in our communities to suffer. WA's health budget will only increase as extra pressures mount unless we have timely targets and change strategies. There's a key role to be played by government and the unions, but also businesses across health, from large pathology and private hospitals to small. They should also meet targets and be part of the innovation as we adapt. We support proposals for the establishment of climate sustainability units at state and national level, national and state targets, the development of a national and state climate and health strategy, and a repository of best practice solutions that have been identified that may be shared, including from other jurisdictions. We will consider using the industrial system as far as possible to support and encourage action. We think that our industrial agreements and contracts of employment will need to be reconsidered with the imperatives of climate change. We want to see change as well as measures to support and protect our members. For example, we may be seeking things like provisions for volunteer emergency services leave and perhaps hardship provisions for anyone affected by fire, flood, storms, etc., that is over and above existing sort of personal leave entitlements. We notice that as far back as 2009, the ACTU was calling for more action on climate change and recognition of the following rights in enterprise agreements. The right to participate in decision-making related to environmental concerns in the workplace, the right to know and understand the environmental hazards in the workplace, along with workplace emissions, technological changes, and plans for energy saving, use and efficiency. Whistleblower protection so a worker may not be held liable or disciplined for reporting workplace practices that are honestly believed to pose an environmental risk, the right to refuse dangerous work, and the right to refuse work which harms the environment. As a major employer, the government may care to develop some standard clauses that could be inserted into public sector enterprise agreements as a model for those that could flow through to private sector agreements. This would be a signal of government concern and an indicator that real action is expected.
Can I ask, are there any gender-specific issues we should be aware of? We've heard about vulnerability and vulnerable groups in the population, and often female gender interacts with, you know, social isolation or other types of disadvantage because of the place of women in the economically in society. And there's some literature around women internationally being particularly at risk in natural disasters. Not so sure about the evidence in Australia. Is there any view you have around gender issues that we should be aware of or look further at?
Yeah, there was a bit we had prepared for the next question. I'll just maybe do that last paragraph.
Yeah.
Cheryl, there's a gender component to climate change as it impacts on women in the workforce, so it may not be as stark in the Western world as in other areas. Women are the largest portion of the caring workforce and so will be disproportionately affected by both work and family caring responsibilities. This has been recognised by groups such as the UN, UNESCO and many other agencies. However, due to the number of women now in the workforce, they are also key to driving change in our health, aged care, disability and community organisations. We don't have a lot of information on this, but I did find that there was a meeting held in 2015 in Canada in the Simon Fraser University on climate change and gender in rich countries, and they have quite a few discussion papers that you might find enlightening. I didn't have time to have a look at them in any great detail. There's also been a book that came out of that meeting in 2015 exactly with the same title, Climate Change and Gender in Rich Countries, Work, Public Policy and Action. And I think there will definitely be a gender impact. There is in any other part of society with anything else that goes on in the working environment, but it's a little bit tricky to be too definitive about what exactly that will mean at this point in time.
We've just got 5 minutes left, so I've just got one question, but also feel free to offer any other closing comments you'd like to make. So Unionists for Climate Justice is one of the union-based networks identified on your website. Can you provide more information about this group, its purpose, and whether climate change is a key concern for the union movement as a whole?
Yes, Naomi. Unionists for Climate Justice is a relatively recent group within Unions WA, which is the peak union body for WA. It was formed both with express support for, especially to take action to reduce climate change, but also to support segments of the workforce whose jobs will be affected by measures taken to reduce emissions. It is made up of union members and officials who are agitating for climate action within the union movement. The group's been active in making sure that unions in WA and various individual unions have been stepping up to support the grassroots climate movement and particularly the school strike for climate. The Unions WA Council and Executive have repeatedly and unanimously endorsed the school climate movement and their actions, and unions have provided direct support. The union movement in WA is strongly in favour of action on climate change, and that workers and communities benefit from the transition to a low carbon economy. And on a national level, the ACTU, as Cheryl has mentioned, has been active for well over a decade and advocating for action on climate change. The climate, energy and just transition is the ACTU policy that was most recently endorsed in 2018. Unions have a proud heritage of environmental protection. One of the most high-profile actions in living memory was the use of green bands in the 1970s by the BLF, the Builders Labour Federation, to protect parklands and green spaces in cities. Unions have policy positions on climate that address the issues from both the perspective of the general societal impact, but unions also seek to entrench rights for the workforce to have control over workplace exposure to hazards that arise from climate change. The ACTU is a member of the Australian Climate Roundtable. Members include the Australian Aluminium Council, the Conservation Foundation, obviously the ACTU, the Australian Energy Council, the Australian Industry Group, National Farmers Federation and Wildlife Australia. So it's a very collaborative group. The Australian Climate Roundtable is a broad alliance of major Australian businesses, environmental, farmer, investor and union welfare groups. That came together in 2014 because climate change and climate policy impacts our missions and our members. In the process, the roundtable found that despite very different constituencies and focuses, the group had much in common, and this is captured in the joint principles for climate policy. And that policy is, we believe Australia should play its fair part in global efforts to avert dangerous climate change and the serious economic, social and environmental impacts that unconstrained climate change would have on Australia. We will work to continue to build common ground in climate policy debate and encourage a just, effective and efficient response.
Ms. Hamill, Ms. McRae, thank you both very much for your attendance at today's hearing. A transcript of this hearing will be sent to you so that you can correct minor factual errors before it is placed on the public record. If you could please return the transcript within 10 working days of the date of the covering letter or email. Otherwise, it will be deemed to be correct. While you cannot amend your evidence, if you would like to explain particular points in more detail or present further information, you can provide this as a submission to the inquiry when you return the transcript. Once again, thank you very much for your evidence.
Thank you.